You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this week around our region. Joining me live in studio today are Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello.
Some big news coming out of the Boise School District, Kevin. Don Coberly, the superintendent, has announced his retirement and apparently just going to hire someone in the next couple days.
Yeah, it's been a strange week at the Boise District, and I think announcing his retirement may be overstating it a little bit. This came out very, very quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we got wind of it on Wednesday was that we were hearing rumblings that there was going to be a special Boise School Board meeting that we really should attend. Well, when we saw the agenda posted about just barely 24 hours ahead of the meeting, just barely in compliance with the state law, there were two items on the agenda. The first was to accept the retirement from the superintendent. That kind of gets your attention.
A little bit.
The second agenda item was to approve a succession plan. So what we have going on here is that Don Coberly is retiring at the end of the school year after 35 or so years in the Boise School District, including 9 as superintendent. And now the Boise School Board has all but selected a successor. They've invited the deputy superintendent, Kobe Dennis, a 25-plus year employee of the district. They've invited Dennis to interview for the job, which effectively makes him the only candidate for the job. And the board is hoping to have this deal done by the end of the before Christmas break. So we're looking at a 2-week window here. So a very fast process, and also a fairly behind closed doors process.
Yeah.
The interview will take place in an executive session. There's not going to be a public component. And I think about how when the Nampa School District hired a new superintendent a couple of years ago, had an external national search, brought in candidates from outside the district, had sessions with the finalists meeting with parents or staff or students, really anybody who wanted to get to know the finalists and ask questions. There will be no such component with Kobe Dennis. The only public component, which again is pretty much all the law requires, is for the board to vote on the hire in an open session. That's going to be it. So it is a very fast process. It's a very unusually fast process, especially when you figure that Coberly is staying on through the end of the year, through the end of the school year, through June. So there's not an immediate situation, and there's really not an emergency. There's not like turmoil going on within the Boise School District like we saw a few years back in West Ada when Linda Clark resigned abruptly amidst a really bitter power struggle with trustees. Nothing like that going on in the Boise District. So a very fast process, very unusual process that we had no idea was coming.
So is there anything, you know, that people should be concerned about, or is what you said, because it's kind of business as usual, we're just going to kind of keep that ball rolling because this person is the deputy superintendent, I mean, right underneath the superintendent, or is there an argument to be made that this should have been opened up to a national search?
Well, and that was the argument within the school board on Thursday. Dennis Doan, who's also the fire chief in Boise and the newest member of the school board, he was just appointed in October, he led an unsuccessful push to slow down the process and open it up to external candidates. And his point basically was, look, I have no qualms with Kobe Dennis. This is not meant to be a criticism of him, nor is it meant to exclude internal candidates from applying. But let's open this process up. Let's have a more transparent process. Let's take our time. What is the rush here, was what he was saying. His motion to broaden the search failed on a 5-2 vote. And, talking to Nancy Gregory, the president of the school board afterwards, she's saying, well, there is a reason we want to move quickly. We want to get this taken care of.
And what was her reason?
A variety of reasons that basically the district begins its budgeting process in January. You've got the legislature to watch and contend with anything that's coming down from the legislature as it affects school districts. Also, she is expecting that, assuming that Kobe Dennis is the next superintendent, you may have a domino effect within the district, other folks moving into other positions. It was a classic debate about whether you groom from within and you provide an opportunity for somebody from within to apply for another position and kind of get the return on the investment that you've made in human capital, as opposed to let's have a more broad search and see who applies to mm-hmm. be the superintendent of, right now, a fairly well-run school district with fairly good student achievement in a growing community. You would think it would have been an attractive job mm-hmm. to school administrators from around the state and around the country, but I don't think we're ever going to find out, assuming that this plays out as it seems to be. This is all going to be done within a few days.
Does it hurt to open it up and then choose Kobe Dennis at the end of that process?
That was the Dennis Doan argument, and ultimately only one other trustee sided with him on it was, well, you know, what's the rush here? Why are we moving so quickly? But the board seems to be determined to move pretty quickly.
As of December 21st, basically.
December 21st is kind of their unofficial target date.
All right, so 2 weeks from today. Scott, a pretty explosive piece in the Idaho Press earlier this week regarding Idaho prisoners who are being held in a private prison in Texas. Get us up to date on this, because there's some shocking things that came out of this. I mean, I don't think I'm over exaggerating by using the word shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, earlier this year, Idaho started shipping off prisoners to a couple of private facilities in Texas. And you might remember back in the spring, there were reports of riots at those prisons, and we were hearing complaints. And then over the past month or so, we started talking to prisoners who are being housed in one of the facilities, the Eagle Pass Correctional Facility. And they were telling us, you know, some things about the conditions there, you know, everything from tight quarters, which you might expect, mm-hmm. but tight quarters, lack of medical care. We had one prisoner tell us that he had to pull out his own tooth that had become abscessed because it was a long wait for a dentist, and he couldn't see a dentist for a long time, and so he pulled his own tooth. Bad food, leaky roofs, just a whole host of complaints. And one of the common threads here was that that these were supposedly the best inmates that we had in Idaho that we were sending off to Texas, because this private company, Geo Group, did not want to take prisoners that had mental health issues or drug addiction issues or behavioral problems. And so, you know, to some extent, this was the best of the best. And one of the folks that we talked to was James Morningstar, who was working at the St. Anthony work camp, earning about $800 a month to pay his restitution for a drug charge. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, he's down in Texas in a small tier of cells where they were putting eight inmates in one cell. So this speaks to the cramped quarters, and that they weren't moving about. They weren't outside in a recreational area. So there were just a whole host of complaints. And unbeknownst to us, State Senator Jim Rice and State Representative Greg Cheney, both Canyon County legislators, had gone down there the week before while we were doing these interviews, and we didn't know that they had gone down there. And so our story came out on Sunday, and then Monday morning, we started hearing that Rice and Cheney had been down there and visited. And their take on it after we talked to them was that the prisoners were exaggerating, that the prison really wasn't that bad. And according to Jim Rice, it has a good smell. So that is an indication that it's a fine establishment. And so, you know, the state is in a bit of a difficult position because they've got overcrowding here at home. Mm-hmm. They're going to be facing a proposal to expand the state prison system mm-hmm. by $500 million, a new prison.
And the head of the IDOC is retiring.
Right. And we've got a new director of correction, Josh Tewalt. And so they're going to be faced with some tough decisions. And there's really not a great appetite, especially during the candidate forums, from legislators mm-hmm. to build a new prison. But Jerem Wagner, representative from Caldwell, he did, you know, he said, yeah, I don't really want to build a new prison, but this is the situation we're in. We've got mm-hmm. almost 1,000 inmates down in Texas in these private prison spending $1 million a month, over $1 million a month, to house these prisoners in these two facilities in Texas.
So we're paying upwards of $12 million a year as taxpayers to house prisoners out of state.
Right. And going to a prison, a private prison company, the GEO Group, is getting all that money to house our prisoners.
And, you know, and we've heard these stories anecdotally. I think anyone in the media here would say that all of us have heard anecdotal stories. So to then have lawmakers go down and then say, oh, it's fine. Mm-hmm. How does that go over?
Yeah, you know, and the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Right.
You know, I don't think these prisoners are lying. I think that and I think they're realistic. They're not saying, no, we're not looking for a Taj Mahal, but you've got we haven't left this tier of cells in 2 months and we haven't had outdoor recreation. We get it that, you know, we don't not expecting great conditions, but, you know, this is just a little ridiculous.
You shouldn't have to pull your own tooth.
Right. And, you know, I think Rice and Cheney, Jim Rice told us that he thinks that prisoner is lying, that that didn't happen. I don't know if it's true or not. It seems hard to say that you'd make up something like that. So, like I said, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, but something is definitely going on. And I think you've got almost 1,000 Idaho prisoners who are now 2,000 miles away, and it's a hardship on their families who want to see them. We talked to a woman who went and moved to Eagle Pass to be near her boyfriend so that she could come see him every day. Mm-hmm. And so it creates a hardship on the families as well. And so I don't think anybody would argue that it's a good thing to send our prisoners out of state to Texas like this.
And speaking of incarceration, there's going to be a jail bond in Canyon County in May on the ballot. Now, this is what, the fourth attempt in
10
a decade?
Years, yeah.
Okay, and so we're bringing in some help.
Right. And so they haven't actually officially announced that they're going to put it on the ballot. They still have to take a vote to put it on the ballot. And but what they did do was they're putting out a solicitation of interest, I think it's called, for essentially PR firms to sell the idea. So they're looking for a firm or a person to do some community outreach for the bond if and when it does go on the ballot to try to help them sell this to the public and get it approved. They haven't even said how much the bond would be. They, of course, have this $187 million price tag that a consultant has told them it's going to cost. But they, you know, they're very fearful of putting a $187 million bond on a ballot, obviously.
And we should note that this is also the county jail that is moving in the basically
trailers
to house inmates in the parking lot.
Right. So while all this is going on, Canyon County is this spring moving in these steel cargo trailers to house female inmates to ease the overcrowding in the county jail.
We're continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Joining me live in studio are Scott McIntosh with Idaho Press and Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. Kevin, you were in here last week talking about a huge series that you were writing about Idaho education, in particular our go-on rates. And Idaho Education News just held a town hall this week.
Right. And with partnership with Boise State Public Radio and seemingly a cast of thousands. We've
exactly.
had a lot of support along the way. It was really an interesting event. We had a panel of eight educators, students, a member of the State Board of Education, several folks that I'd spoken to in the reporting of that series. And what I really wanted and what I hope we got was a chance for everyday Idahoans to hear from people on the front lines of this issue of what are we doing to encourage students to continue their education past high school. So you heard from a high school senior who is planning to go to college, a second-year student at College of Southern Idaho who is a first-gen college student, and the university officials who are trying to support them, and educators from the K-12 system. The conversation is available. It's on our website, so you can rewatch or watch the 90 minutes. I think it's well worth your while, and I know you all are going to rebroadcast it. I thought it was what I kind of took away from it was when we opened it up four questions from the audience. A couple of people brought up all-day kindergarten, pre-K. Sonia Galavis, who is a member of the panelist, who's a nationally recognized fifth grade teacher in Boise, talked about, look, if we're trying to make this change, we have to be talking to kids in grade school. And we have to be talking to the parents of those kids, maybe more importantly. It just sort of left me struck again by the long horizon here on this. If we're really trying to get, you know, grade school kids and middle school kids to think about where they're going to want to be down the road, long before they're ever entering the workforce. I mean, this is a 20-year process to try to convince, you know, today's grade school student to think about where they're going to be when they hit this 25 to 34-year-old cohort in the workforce. So the idea that we're going to get to this goal in 7 years, like we talked about previously, that doesn't feel realistic. And if you're talking about making systemic and cultural changes, generational changes, that's really going to take a long time. That was kind of my takeaway.
And what's interesting, too, though, getting back to the whole idea of pre-K and kindergarten, because this comes up over and over again. Last week, when we did the reporter roundtable, Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television talked about, you know, Idaho City.
Mm-hmm.
And we've
yes.
talked about this before, but they now have close to 20 years of data because they funded pre-K. And I don't know if I have the percentage correct, but of those kids who have gone from pre-K, I believe their go-on rate is at 65%.
Mm-hmm.
So you have almost 20 years of data in front of you from a school district that is, you know, not in the urban center.
Right. A rural district, you know, far from a college campus. I mean, yeah, to see some improvement in the go-on numbers and, you know, obviously Basin feels like there's, you know, a causal link here between pre-K and the go-on rates. You know, and I guess that was another takeaway from the series for me, was that it's going to take a lot of different projects, a lot of different innovations, try it out at a lot of communities, and maybe, you know, maybe you try to, you know, apply them in other communities. Maybe you take some best practices from one place and move them someplace else.
And we have to have legislators in on the conversation.
Yes.
And speaking of legislators, there was an organizational meeting Wednesday because there was some it ended up not being a lot of shakeup, but let's talk about where the leadership is at coming January 7 when we go into session.
Yeah, so Scott Bedke retained his position as Idaho House Speaker after a challenge from Representative Brent Crane from NAMPA. I don't know if that was necessarily a surprise that Bedke maintained his position. We had other positions that stayed the same. The thing about this is that when you run for another position, you kind of lose your position. So Brent Crane had a position in the majority leadership, and because he was running for the speaker position, he lost his position. So that opened up his position, and Jason Monks defeated Terry Gestrin from Donnelly for the assistant majority leader position. John Vanderwoude, he also ran for a position, challenging House Majority Leader Mike Moyle, and Mike Moyle kept his position over Vanderwoude. And so then that opened up a three-way race for the majority caucus chair, and Representative Megan Blanksma from Hammett won that position. And then on the Senate side, in a rematch between Senate Assistant Majority Leader Steve Vick of Dalton Gardens and Senator Todd Lakey, whom Vick defeated for that position last session, Vick again kept that position. So, you know, not a lot of big changes, but always kind of an interesting, fun little contest that goes on.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you Scott, wrote an opinion piece the other day in the Idaho Press, and you talked about the access that we have to our elected officials in Idaho.
Yeah.
And I think that we can all agree that when we talk to other people, I mean, journalists, but just normal people in other states about, you know, the type of access we have, I think people don't believe us.
Yeah. No, and the story that I told when I first moved to Idaho, I had been an Idaho resident for all of 2 months, and Governor Otter, Butch Otter, who was running for governor at the time, was on the campaign bus tour. And Miss Lori, Lori Otter was with him, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Lori.
And we're walking across the park. I was asking questions and taking photos.
Yeah, you're doing your job as a journalist.
And then all of a sudden, Lori Otter took my arm and started asking me questions about where I was from and, you know, how I got to Idaho. And I'm strolling across the park with Lori Otter. And, you know, and that is not it is definitely, having lived in New York and California and New Jersey and other places around the country, for me it was definitely shocking, the access. And the capital for a day, I cannot overstate how important that is. And I hope Brad Little continues doing that, that the capital for a day where they go to these small towns and meet with average citizens. And I told another story about Melba town capital for a day. And, you know, you've got the governor and the lieutenant governor and the state superintendent of public education. And anybody can just come in and talk to them and bend their ear and complain and whatever. And so it really is remarkable in this state how open and accessible the public officials are.
How critical do you think that makes it to being able to do our job as journalists? And I would pose that to both of you, because, I mean, in a way, this type of access is kind of unprecedented.
It is. We do enjoy much better access to elected officials than our counterparts in many states. But my concern is that it may be that access may be tightening up. And I've certainly seen the change over the past few years with the redesign of the Capitol. And I'm not the only person who's made this observation that, you know, lawmakers, every lawmaker now has his or her own office. Time was that lawmakers did a lot of their work during the course of the day on the floor of the Senate or the House. It was very easy for a reporter to see a legislator at his or her desk in this kind of common area and just walk up and ask them a few questions about a bill they were working on or how they voted. The access is a little bit tighter now. It's a little bit more, you have to, you don't make as many impromptu chance encounter interviews with lawmakers as you used to be able to do. And I don't know if that's, and I think that makes the job a little bit more difficult now. Mm-hmm. But still, you can find most everybody that you're looking for.
Yeah, unless they're trying to hide from you.
Unless they're really trying to hide from you. And then that becomes part of the story.
It does happen, yeah.
And that becomes
yeah.
part of the story when it happens, yeah. Certainly.
But even, you know, the capital for a day that has happened, which has happened all over the state, that is something where, you know, you don't necessarily always see in other states. And what's interesting to me about it is, our state isn't that easy to access sometimes.
Right.
Right?
Right. A lot of the capital for the day is usually in a rural, very remote city, Winchester or Melba, all over the state. And it really does give folks an opportunity who can't come to Boise, who can't come to during a session and speak with the statewide officers. Mm-hmm. So it really is a great thing. And I hope Brad Little continues it.
I want to thank both of you for coming in today. Always a fun conversation. You've been listening to our Reporter Roundtable, and my guest today, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press and Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. Thanks again for coming in and chatting.
Thank you. Happy Friday.